Our scripture lesson this morning is from the Gospel of John, chapter 11, verses 45 and 47 and 53. Also, chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. Would you stand, please, for the reading of the Word of God? Many, therefore, of the Jews who had come to Mary and beheld what he had done, believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs." From that day on, they planned together to kill him. Chapter 12. Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a supper there, and Martha was serving. But Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary, therefore, took a pound of very costly, genuine spikenard ointment, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the ointment. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was intending to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people?" Now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. Jesus therefore said, "Let her alone, in order that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you have always with you, but you do not always have me." The word of the Lord. You may be seated.
Let's pray together, please. Father, we come to your word, and we come as needy and hungry pilgrims, people who were as hungry as those who came to this dinner party in Bethany. But our hunger, Lord, is deeper and more compelling than simply for food. It is a hunger for life, a hunger for the truth that will set us free, hunger for the hope that will make sense of all of the different pieces of our lives, hunger in the end, Lord, for you. May we see this morning in what Mary did to you, Lord, something of that attitude which will lead us to delight in you and to find our deepest satisfaction in you. In Christ's name we do pray. Amen. There is an outline provided for you. If that is of some use, please feel free to use it. Well, in this passage, we find one of the most choice and beautiful little nuggets we have in the Gospel of John. It's a wonderful passage that is filled with much human emotion, much honesty, much treachery in the form of Judas, of course, much devotion in the form of Mary. But it's important that we understand something of the setting in order to appreciate more fully the dynamics that are brought to bear in this short but very compelling and important passage. There's a dinner party being given in Bethany. Bethany, you may remember, is a suburb of Jerusalem, just outside of Jerusalem by a couple of miles. An account of this passage, or a similar account, the scholars think it's parallel accounts. There's considerable differences, but there's a lot of similarities as well, are in Matthew 26 and Mark 14. When you put all of these together, all three of them together, you see a total picture of what's going on here. Jesus, as you may recall from a couple of weeks ago, John chapter 11, previous chapter, had just raised Lazarus from the dead. And now Mary and Martha, in celebration of the new life that's been given to their brother, want to have a dinner party. Jesus is the honored guest at this dinner party. Martha, no doubt in character, is running around, getting all the arrangements made, very practical, making sure everyone is happy, making sure the dinner is hot and served properly. But Mary comes in and does an extraordinarily impractical thing. It's actually quite amazing. And what she does demonstrates or shows three things about her relationship to Jesus. It shows the conditions of her love, it shows the confidence of her worship, and it shows the consciousness she has of the gospel. And I want us to look at these three characteristics and unpack this whole passage and see something of the cultural background and some of what's going on in Mary's heart and the heart of others here, following this particular outline. First, the conditions of Mary's love. The question is this: what were the conditions Mary attached to her love of Jesus? Now, when Mary first approaches Jesus, no one is surprised at first. What she does is she takes a pound of pure nard, a very, very expensive perfume. And in those times, this would be very common. When you would have a dinner party, when you would have a very special occasion and you invited your friends and family to be there, it would be normal to bring out the perfume. Why? Well, no one would have had a shower before they came to this particular dinner party. There were no baths in those days. There were no deodorants. There were no perfumes. There were no aftershaves. It's a hot climate. Everything smelled bad. Everyone smelled bad. And you could say, in fact, you might want to say, well, back then they knew how to handle all these bad smells. I'm not so sure. You know, by our reckoning, they smelled. And by their reckoning, I think they smelled too. And so when it came to a special occasion, nobody wanted to eat their dinner with all these bad smells. So they would get out the fragrance. They would get out the perfume. And the host or hostess would dab a bit on your head or your face when you came in. And so immediately what would happen is this very strong, compelling odor would fill the air and sort of cloak the other bad smells. And all this would be expected. But what Mary does is completely unexpected, and it's startling. In Mark chapter 14, the parallel passage, it says that when she does this, what I'm about ready to tell you she does, that they rebuked her sharply. And the word there for rebuke sharply is to bellow or snort as an animal in anger. In fact, you may recall that it's the same word that was used in the last chapter, chapter 11, when Jesus stands before the tomb of Lazarus and snorts angrily at death. That's what it says that these people do to Mary. What she does is so outrageous and so outlandish that everyone yelled at her. What did she do? She did three things that demonstrate the unconditionality of her devotion to Jesus. Three things by which Mary says, I am not going to respond to Jesus with any conditions. First, she pours all the perfume out. Verse 3 says that it's a pound of very costly, genuine spikenard ointments. And Mark, in his account, adds that she broke the vial or the box or the jar in which the perfume was contained in order to pour it out. This means that she did not put on just a little dab. A little dab will do you, Jesus. She didn't do that. She broke open the whole thing. She poured it all out. The house was filled with the fragrance. The fragrance must have been overpowering. Imagine if a little dab had the effect of a very powerful perfume. If a little dab had the effect to change the quality and character of the smell in the house. Imagine what the smell was like with this entire vial poured out. The reason that people were so angry was that this perfume was very, very expensive. 300 denarii worth, Judas says, which was in fact about almost a year's wages. Now, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, we can presume from the various accounts of them in the Gospels, were fairly well-off people. But unless they were extraordinarily wealthy, I mean, unless they were private jet kind of wealthy, This perfume would have been the most valuable thing they owned. Mark says it was in an alabaster vial or flask. This means that it was a family heirloom. It was passed down from generations to generations. It was kept intact. Just a tiny dab being put on the special guests at special occasions only. It meant that it was that this vial of very valuable spikenard was the family's financial security. It was their hedge against disaster. In other words, if you had an earthquake or a famine or a Y2K non-event, so that the family was no longer able to make a livelihood, there would be some security. And so when they first saw Mary bring out the alabaster vial, they thought, what an honor. She's going to put a little bit on Jesus. Isn't that wonderful? But then she breaks the whole thing and pours it out. Gasp! Here Mary is saying, I will not let my following Jesus be conditioned by cost. She is not saying, I will follow you as long as it's not too costly. As long as it's not too expensive, I will follow you. As long as it's profitable for me. As long as it works to my advantage. She's not saying that at all. She's saying just the opposite. I am willing to give you anything, she says. I am willing to give you everything. She's not giving a 10% tithe here. No, she's probably giving about 85 or 90% of her net worth. She's saying, I'm going to follow you no matter what the cost. That's the first thing she does, is she pours it all out. The second thing she does is she anoints Jesus' feet with the perfume. Now, this was a time and a place when dealing with feet was considered very demeaning. When she touches his feet, the cost of her devotion goes up. In the Bible, whenever slavery is discussed, you need to remember that it's not like the slavery that we have known in the West in the last 300 years, the inhumane slavery that we have known in Western civilization. When a Jewish person fell into debt, and if they were unable to repay that debt, they couldn't go to bankruptcy court. What they had to do was to go into servitude for a time in order to work off their debt. And in doing so, they would lose many of their rights. But the rabbi said that there was one sort of right that they would never lose. There were certain things that you could never ask a person to do, even if they were your meanest and lowest slave or serf. And one of those things that you could never ask a servant to do would be to untie your shoes or in any way to touch your feet. And this is why the disciples, especially Peter, will be completely put off in the next chapter when Jesus does precisely that and he comes to them and seeks to wash their feet. It's scandalous. It's unbelievable that anyone would do that. And so what Mary is saying, she's saying, I know a servant has rights, but I give mine up. I hold no rights when I stand before you, Lord. That's what she's saying. Even my right to have a servant's dignity, I don't hold on to that. There's nothing you may not ask of me. Touching his feet was a pledge of unconditional service. The third thing that amazed everyone was that she wiped his feet with her hair. And in order to do so, of course, she had to unbound her hair and let it down. This was the most scandalous thing of all. For a woman in the ancient world would never let down her hair in public. The rabbi said that if a married woman let down her hair in public, it was grounds for divorce. They said that if a single woman let down her hair in public, it could be grounds for stoning. Why? Well, like our culture today, but actually even more so, when a woman unbinds her hair, it's a way of expressing what? Openness, intimacy, love. And this is something that a woman would only do at home and only with her closest family members. And so when Mary lets down her hair to wipe Jesus' feet, she is saying, there is now no conditionality to my devotion to you. You see, what she's really saying is that it's possible to serve the Lord with her wealth, to give away the perfume. That it's possible to serve the Lord with her effort, with her work, with her service. But it's still possible to withhold something. Mary's saying, it's still possible that I could be withholding my heart, my devotion, my joy. It's possible to give all of my possessions, Paul says in his famous chapter on love in 1 Corinthians 13, even to give my body to be burned, but not to have love. In other words, we can say to Jesus, I know I owe you my wealth. I know I owe you my very life. But it's possible to do that and still not delight in him. I'll give you what I should. I'll even give it to you unconditionally, but I don't have to like it. I'll do my duty. I'll be a good soldier. What more do you want of me? And what Mary teaches us is the more that the Lord wants of us is our heart. That in the end, he doesn't just want our wealth. He doesn't want our time. He doesn't want our effort. What the Lord wants is our heart. He wants our delight in him. He wants us to delight in him more than we delight in anything else. And so what we must not say is, I'm going to give you my stuff, and I'm going to give you my time, but I'm going to continue to put my deepest delight in my work, or in my athletic skills, or in my recreation, or in my social advantages and opportunities, or even in my family. They bellowed at her. This is too much, they said. This is a public display that is unbecoming. They were offended at what she did because they saw underneath it the devotion of her heart that shamed them all, that made them understand how little they were giving, even if they were giving their money and their time and their effort, how little they were giving to the Lord. And Jesus says, leave her alone. You see, in all three of these ways, the perfume, the feet, and especially the hair, Mary is saying, I'm not going to respond to Jesus with any conditions. When Mary pours out the perfume, she's saying, in effect, take my silver and my gold, not a mite would I withhold. And when she touches his feet, she's saying, take my will and make it thine. It shall no longer be mine. But when she lets down her hair, she says, take my love, O Lord, I pour. At thy feet, its treasure store. Take myself, and I will be ever only all for thee. I'm giving you my deepest delight, she says. Now, who is the person in this passage that is compared to Mary? Judas. John, the gospel writer, intentionally makes a comparison between two extremes, you might say. The utter devotion of Mary and the hypocritical, false, fake devotion of Judas. Judas says in verse 5, why was this perfume not sold and the proceeds given to the poor? Why does Mary get contrasted to Judas? John is making a point, isn't he? He's saying that in the end, there's only two options. Sell Jesus out or be sold out to Jesus. To use Jesus or to make myself available to be used. You see, the issue that Mary presents to us is this. Am I sticking with the Lord as long as he does what I need? As long as he helps me with my problems? Do I hang in there with the Lord as long as he blesses me? Or am I delighting in the Lord for who he is? Am I using God or am I loving him? Love God and you will use everything else. Rightly use it. But love something else ahead of God and you will end up using God. Using him for your own advantage. And in the end, my dear friends, God will not tolerate to be used. God is not a means to an end. He is the end of all my means. Have you ever said, what good is it for me to trust God when all these difficulties come into my life? Have you ever said that? Why do I believe in God when all these things are going wrong in my life? Mary learned that whatever God sends, whatever He gives to her, that she will not only obey Him, but she will work it into her heart so that she will learn to love the Lord in the midst of this particular circumstance, however difficult it is. Take myself, and I will be ever, only, all for Thee, no matter what the circumstance, no matter what the difficulty. Work it into your heart so that no matter how bad things get, those bad things actually become the provocation to learn to love the Lord more in the midst of those bad things. I'm looking at faces of people who over the last 8 years I've grown to love and know that You've done just that. In the midst of unexpected illnesses, in the midst of tragedies unexpected, You have not allowed Yourself to get hard before the Lord. In fact, what You have said is, Lord, work this into my heart so that in the end, my chief delight is You. You are more to me than life itself. That's what Mary teaches us. I will give to Him and I will serve Him and I will like it. Because I won't just give Him my treasure, my time, my talent, but I'll give Him my heart. So you see there the conditions of Mary's love. Are there any? There are none. There are no conditions. And they can't stand it. They bellow at her because she's a rebuke to them. But then even more, we see the confidence of her worship. Not only the conditions of her love, or the non-conditions of her love, we might say, but the confidence of her worship. It's an interesting question in this passage. Who is it who is so upset with Mary? It's the religious folks. They thought she was too extreme. They thought she was undignified, didn't they? They thought she was presumptuous. Religious people can't figure Mary out. And most of the reason is because of the hair. You see, religious people will give their money. Sure, the church needs my money. Here's my check. The religious people will give their time. The Lord needs me. Yeah, sure, I'll sign up. But religious people do not let their hair down. Letting her hair down shows that Mary is confident. Remember what we said? In those days, a woman would only let her hair down in the atmosphere where she was confident that she would be accepted and loved. It was a sign of closeness and intimacy with the people who did indeed accept her. Religious people don't have that sort of confident intimacy with the Lord. Religious people have to do it right or else God's going to snap my hand. Religious people have to perform for God. And what Mary says is there's no performance that will ultimately earn God's acceptance. She is confident in the reality that she has been accepted. She can't believe it. She's overwhelmed with it. She delights in it. There's nothing to do but take the Lord's acceptance and delight in it. There's nothing that she can offer back that's worthy of what she has received. And she realizes that. And she worships with a kind of unfeigned heart, an openness of heart, an eagerness that demonstrates that her worship is prompted by her receiving the Lord's grace. She pours out her worship lavishly, luxuriously, extravagantly. Now, this passage is not primarily about corporate worship. It's primarily about individual worship, Mary's individual devotion to the Lord. But there are some inferences about our corporate worship that can rightly be drawn from this passage. There is a beauty and dignity to worship, isn't there? There is. And there's a language, in fact, the rhythms of worship. Rhythms and language that Rob and I and others and Colin, we work very hard on that every week to try and create an atmosphere in this room that is indeed very worshipful. We beg the Lord to come and do it because we know we can't. So there is a sort of dignity to worship. But dignity is not stuffiness or stiffness. In fact, I don't think in the end that dignity is the right word for describing Mary's worship at all. The right words are intensity, reality, intimacy, delight. The psalmist says, delight yourself in the Lord. And he goes on to explain that in terms of delighting ourselves in what the Lord did for us in terms of the gospel. So this is what I'm saying to you. Lavish worship is intense, real, and sometimes honest, embarrassingly honest. Gasp! Sometimes there should be gasps in here. Sometimes there should be an honesty in your own heart as you come into the presence of the Lord that if what was in your heart were known by that brother or sister or that son or daughter next to you, you would be embarrassed. Lavish worship is intense and real and honest because it's an expression of the confidence we may have before the Lord because He's lavished His grace-filled acceptance upon us. Stiffness in worship is wrong. Stuffiness in worship is wrong. It shows that our hearts have not been melted. It shows that we don't know how to let down our hair. It shows that we know how to write the check and put it in the offering basket. It shows that we may know how to sign up for the committee and serve the Lord, but we do not know how to worship. And so there should be, amidst all of the wonderful dignity in this room, in this place, there should be an atmosphere that also is real and intense. I'll never forget once, a young woman came to me and she was actually seeking to be a member in the church. And as one elder in the church, as our elders do, I was interviewing her for membership together with another elder. And we said, well, when did you come to know the Lord? She says, don't you know? And I said, no. She said, I came to know the Lord in our worship services on Sunday morning. I said, well, how? What did I say? And she said nothing. She said it was God's people. It was the reality that the Lord is in your midst. It was worship so thick, and these were her exact words, I could cut it with a knife. Lavish worship. And Mary is confident before the Lord, and that leads her to that kind of worship. But she's also confident before others. And that leads her to a combination of humility plus boldness. Mary doesn't really care what other people think. She doesn't care what a woman should or shouldn't do in this setting, what's appropriate culturally. She doesn't care what Martha thinks. She doesn't care what the other men in the room think. Religious people always care what others think. They're very concerned about appearances, about traditions, about holding on to cultural mores in order to shore up their sense of well-being, of doing well. I've been reading a book just the last few days by a woman named Gail Godwin. She's a contemporary novelist, and she writes about people, very interestingly. She writes about a certain kind of person, a person who, and I quote, is low-voiced and has careful codes in what they say. The very cadences and word choices of their speech calculated to talk around things, to smooth things over, to prettify things, and to exclude people. When we begin, like Mary, to understand the gospel, we don't care so much about careful codes and calculated speech. We don't care so much about what others think of us. Our talk to the Lord and about the Lord is more exuberant. It's less guarded. It's open. I've told you before about a young fellow who was in a wheelchair in our church that Barbara and I served in Virginia, named Martin, on the front row, grew up. Literally, we watched him grow up in this wheelchair. It's cerebral palsy. And he would be on the front row. Sometimes he would get so excited in worship that he just couldn't stand it. And he would just raise his hands and he'd go, wow! I'm ashamed when I think that I'm afraid to let out a wow. And I'm even more ashamed when I realize that there's nothing in my heart to go wow about. You see, when I'm humbled about how much I need the Lord because I'm a sinner, then I'm bold because of how much the Lord has done in loving me and accepting me. And humility, boldness, produces this kind of confidence. Religion doesn't produce it. Religious people don't know how to let their hair down. And the difference between religion and intimacy is confidence that issues in lavish worship. But this is not fanaticism, is it? There's a big difference between fanaticism and adoration. The gospel creates adoration, not fanaticism. What's a test of whether or not you're a fanatic or a worshiper? Here's a test. Fanatics have to be right about their religion. They can't let their guard down. They're argumentative, and they're even bullies about it at times. They're bullies about their understanding of the truth, which is usually truth about them rather than truth about the Lord. Fanatics are dogmatic because their sense of self is at stake. But worshipers are confident, not in themselves or in their ability to defend the Lord, but in the grace of the Lord, who is in the end his own best defender. So worshipers can stand for the truth, and they can even fight for the truth. But you sense that in the end, a true worshiper cares more about the truth than they care about their grasp of it. For the worshiper, there's a grace-driven combination of humility and boldness. Humbly and boldly confident before the Lord. Now, there's one other thing about this kind of confident worship. It's not in the outline. It's actually in addition to the outline. But you can't miss it because it's right in the middle of this passage. It has to do with the poor. Real worship always leads us to a humble care for the poor. The kind of confidence that I'm talking about, the kind of intimacy with the Lord, will inevitably lead people to care about the poor. That's what Jesus is saying here. Some people take this passage to mean that Jesus doesn't have a very high regard for the poor at all. When Judas objects to Mary's lavish worship, he says in verse 5, why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? And we know, as one commentator puts it, that Judas was using greed, actually. His greed was masquerading as altruism. But Jesus responds in verse 8. He says, for the poor you have with you always, but you do not always have me. He's not saying here the poor are unimportant. He's saying just the opposite. He's saying you will always have the poor and you must always care for the poor. But right now, you have me. And worship comes before mercy because in worship I understand again how merciful the Lord has been toward me when I was his enemy. And so the only way to have a heart for the poor, really to have a heart for the poor, is to have a heart for the worship of the Lord. That's what he's saying. In fact, there's so much in the Bible that says this in effect. That if we have little or no regard for the poor, it shows that we actually have little or no regard for worship. Because when we really worship the true God, there will inevitably be in our hearts a turning, a change, a difference of attitude toward the poor, so that we don't say to them, oh, look at those people. Look at how miserably they failed in their life. No, there will be a sense of compassion that's different, that is born out of worship of the Lord, who himself was poor, who cared for the poor, and in our worship of him leads us to do the same. Now look, I need to finish. Not only is Mary unconditional in her love and confident in her worship, she is also conscious about what she's doing, isn't she? When Judas complains about Mary's lavishness, Jesus says in verse 7, let her alone, in order that she may keep it for the day of my burial. In other words, let her alone. Let her do this because she's doing it with reference to my burial. When a person was buried, the dead body would be buried with ointments and perfumes and spices. And some commentators say that Mary must have known about what we Christians call the substitutionary atonement. But it's not likely that she really understood all that yet. It is true, however, that she knew he was going to die. How did she know that? Every time you see Mary in the Gospel of John, where is she? She's at Jesus' feet learning. She's at Jesus' feet listening, learning from him. She was a disciplined learner, and she had heard Jesus teach about his own death. In the last chapter, John chapter 11, Lazarus is raised. Martha comes to Jesus, right? And says, "Oh Lord, if you had been here, then my brother would not have died." And what does Jesus do? He gently rebukes her by teaching her. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life. If you believe in me, you will live forever," and so forth. Goes on to teach him. But then Mary comes to Jesus and says precisely the same words. "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't die." But what does Jesus do? Does he teach her? No, he doesn't need to. He weeps with her. Because she already knows. And Jesus knows she already knows. She's got it. She understands. She understands that he had to die and rise again. And after Lazarus is raised, some of Mary's friends went and told the Pharisees. Look at verse 45 of chapter 11. Mary, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to Mary. Very interesting. It says they came to Mary. It doesn't say Martha. They came to Mary and beheld what he had done, believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. And Mary knew that some of her friends had gone off and squealed to the Pharisees. And she also knew then what is in verse 53. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. Mary knew this. She knew the Pharisees were coming after Jesus, and she is preparing him for his burial. She's very conscious about the fact that his death and burial was the fullest expression of his love for her. She's very aware of his coming death. Even if she doesn't understand what we mean by the substitutionary atonement, she knew that his death was for her, and that consciousness melts her heart. She's really singing a song, isn't she? "Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." Very consciously, Mary gives herself to the Lord when she perceives what Jesus did for her. It's the gospel. His love awakens her love. Has your love for the Lord been awakened? Or do you just dutifully write your checks and sign up for committees? Or has your love for the Lord been awakened by the compelling wonder of what he's done for you? Do you, like Mary, see the wonder of what Jesus accomplished when he died? And does that begin to melt your heart? It's the consciousness of what Jesus will do for her. She's happy, eager, not only to give her wealth and her service, but her heart, because he has already given his heart to her. It's not just a matter, you see, of our acknowledging his lordship. Jesus does not want the grunting, grimacing acknowledgement that he's Lord. He wants the delight of our heart, where he comes to mean more to us than anything else. It's all about our gazing at the beauty of what Jesus has done until Jesus satisfies us, until we want Jesus more than anything. Do you know the expression, "you are what you eat"? Well, I've got a better one for you. You are what you look at. You are what you gaze upon. You are what you admire. And when you gaze upon Jesus until he satisfies you, you are transformed into his likeness. You are what you look at. And when I gaze at, when I wonder at, when I survey with understanding the wondrous cross, when I see, therefore, everything else in my life, my richest gain, when I see it all for what it really is worth, I gladly have contempt for all my prideful attempts to show my worth to God and to others. Love, this amazing, this beautiful, evokes and woos and draws me so that I am eager to give to this Prince of Glory my soul, my life, my all. We began the service by singing that we are to gaze our eyes upon Jesus. And we end by singing of the glory of who he is. And what we are to do is we give our hearts to him, not out of obedience, but out of delight.